You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio, a new series of Bookmark. Hope you had a good summer full of good books. And if you've forgotten, this is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant, with me, Lee Chambers. And kicking us off on the new series, our studio guest is Louise Ells, here to talk about her short story collection, Notes Towards Recovery. We'll also hear from Erin Kelly, her latest novel, Stone Mothers, and Sarah Watling will be talking about her biography of the Olivier sisters, which is called Noble Savages. Louise, welcome to Bookmark.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. It's all women writers on the show today, and I know there's one woman writer in particular who you're very, very devoted to. That's Alice Munro.
Indeed, yes.
Why Alice Munro? What is it about her writing that appeals to you?
Tessa Hadley once said to me that Alice Munro never puts a word in the wrong place. And I just love that idea. So many words and all in exactly the correct place. I'm also Canadian. I come from the same province, though a very different part of it, to Alice Munro. Beyond that, we have very little in common. But I'm fascinated with her use of telling detail and the way she writes time. Her stories, she once said writing and reading is like entering a house and looking around and discovering the connections and looking at the different views. So although her stories have a beginning, middle, and end, they're not always linear. They're not even a classic snake with its tail in its mouth sort of structure. Often they're puzzles, which I really feel have to be puzzled out.
And she's inspired you in your writing, presumably?
Oh, deeply. Absolutely, yes.
And she famously won the Nobel Prize for Literature. Do you think that it was quite something when she won that she's put short stories back on the map, as it were?
Yes, although as a short story writer, I'd like to think they were never off the map. But yes, they've become more recognisable, perhaps, as a form which doesn't have to be a beginning. That sort of question, when's your novel coming out and what's your novel about? But one can just write short stories and write them particularly well and be known for that.
And as you say, you've got being Canadian in common, as we can hear from your accent, but you do have a link to Cambridge as well.
I do indeed. I was lucky enough to live here for 6 years and earn my PhD at Anglia Ruskin University.
And you've been back here now. You're back here to teach the summer school.
Yes, Cambridge programs at Churchill College, Cambridge. Yes. Also very lucky. I do this for 2 weeks every summer.
Well, we'll talk to you about your wonderful short story collection in just a moment. But let's hear your first choice of music now, which is Joni Mitchell and Both Sides Now. Why this one?
She's Canadian, so nod to my Canadian roots. And Flannery O'Connor said once, "I write to discover what I know." It's taken me many years to understand that that's true of myself, too. And in this song, Joni says she doesn't know life. So I think perhaps to some extent I don't know life either, and that's why I write.
Rose and flows of angel hair and ice cream castles in the air and feather canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that weep, but now they only block the sun. They rain and snow on everyone. So many things I would have done, but clouds got in my way. I've looked at clouds from both sides now. I recall, I read.
That's Joni Mitchell and Both Sides Now. The first choice of music from our studio guest on Bookmark today, Louise Els. Louise has a PhD in creative writing from Anglia Ruskin University. In 2017, she was a Hawthornden Fellow. Her work has featured in a range of publications. Notes Towards Recovery is her first short story collection and examines the themes of loss, ageing, family relationships and memory. It's a wonderful collection, Louise. I really, really enjoyed reading this. And you kind of alluded to it before, the music there, that you spent your whole life, in a way, writing these stories. And I read that in an interview as well that you did. What do you mean by that?
Oh, that's a great question. Thank you. So the stories are really looking at loss, and in particular, loss of memory that scaffolds the whole collection. Sadly, when I was a very young, 3 and a half, my older sister died suddenly and unexpectedly overnight. So as I said in that interview, I woke up in the morning with a sister-shaped hole in my life. And although I wasn't aware of it at the time, my mother and father chose different ways to navigate the space around that hole, different ways to deal with that loss. And since then, when I've faced other losses, I've sort of come back to that idea of how do I navigate this space? What do I do with the absence of the person?
And at what point did you want to write about that?
About halfway through my dissertation, I realized I had thought I was writing a different collection, and in fact, it was this collection about loss, absence, space, gaps.
And family loss a lot of the time.
Yes.
So how autobiographical are these stories? Lots are written in the first person, and often you can't help but, particularly with stories and poetry, I think, wonder if it's the writer that is the first person. How much is autobiographical?
The two answers are absolutely none and 100%.
Because it's a very emotional collection. There is a lot about mental health and about loss. Did it? At what point did you think, you know, I'm going to fictionalise this, make, give a different name, put a different twist on it? Or at what point did you think I'm putting me on the page here?
I think every story has a bit of me in some way or the other. I don't think I ever realized, perhaps this will sound naive, that I was taking so much of my life and putting it on the page and fictionalizing it. I really thought I was creating these characters from thin air. Of course I wasn't.
And were you writing as a collection, or was it afterwards that you looked and thought all these stories have a theme?
I was writing towards a collection specifically for my PhD dissertation, but I thought it was, as I said, very different. I thought they were going to be connected by water, and I thought all sorts of other things. So many of the stories I wrote during that time didn't make the final cut, and then these 21 were the ones that came together. So I had a lot of help from the writing group I belonged to at the time, from my supervisor, from my peers, saying this one works, this one doesn't, and here's why.
And what does make a good short story?
In my opinion, someone famous said it's a flash of light glimpsed in passing. I think something very concise, something leaving a lot of unanswered questions, or at least some unanswered questions at the end. My experience is that it's a great genre for looking at loss because by definition they're short. So even as you start reading a story, you're readying yourself for the loss of those characters. It's not going to be a novel or a trilogy. It's going to be brief, and you're going to lose people as soon as you meet them. So everything has to be heightened. Everything has to be important. No wasted words.
And why that form for you? Why not poetry or a novel?
Not poetry, because as much as I love reading poetry, I'm not really a poet. I love to pretend I am, but I'm not. And not a novel in this case, because I think one novel looking at loss from 21 different angles would just be too much. To have a main character who lost 6 husbands and 3 children and both her parents and then all her grandparents in various horrific ways would be unbelievable and not particularly relatable, as my students would say. I think it would be too much to write and certainly too much to read. So this gave me a chance to look at it from various different facets. And
another thing that links them all is the landscape. as Canada, and it's structured around the seasons as well. Why did you choose that structure?
I really love the idea of liminality, of various thresholds, both physical and psychological, and the seasons in Canada certainly speak to liminality. Spring comes and goes in a matter of weeks. Winter lasts forever, but every day is different. Of course, seasons are changing now, given what we've done to our poor world. So they are always thresholds. That answer the
it
question.
Does answer the question. Yes, it's also about small town life as well.
Yes, I grew up in a very small town. My mother still lives there with my stepdad, and I visit regularly. I am at heart a small town girl.
And what comes through in these stories is observation, watching. There's a feeling that, well, lots of the characters watch each other, but also a feeling that the writer has been watching.
It's one of my worst character traits.
It's a curiosity. It's not nosiness. You just have to reframe it. It's a curiosity about what you do regard yourself as a people watcher.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I adore traveling on trains. I adore sitting at airports. I adore sitting on the city street in a cafe somewhere, trying not to stare at people, but figuring out their story or their potential story in my head.
Well, we'll come back to you in just a moment, Louise. But as I mentioned there, one of the themes in Louise's collection is mental health, which leads us nicely to the interview with Erin Kelly to talk about her book, Stone Mothers. Stone Mothers being the description that was used once for mental asylums. Erin's first novel, The Poison Tree, was a Richard and Judy bestseller, became a TV drama and was longlisted for the 2011 Crime Writers Association John Creasy Award. There have been five more critically acclaimed novels since then, including the Sunday Times top 10 bestseller He Said, She Said. Stone Mothers came out earlier this year. Set in Suffolk, it centres around a former mental hospital, now converted to luxury flats, and the secret it holds for the protagonist, Marianne. The Sunday Express described it as crime fiction at its most ingenious, and Nikki French said it's addictively scary and thrillingly audacious. Like Erin's other novels, it explores the impact of the past on the present. And when I met Erin, I asked her what it was about that subject that interested her.
Two reasons. One, I think it's a really interesting, fun way to structure a story. So many of my favourite books have flashback or they work in dual time frames. And I just think that the sense of your past rushing to catch up with you, especially if the past that we're talking about is something that happened when you were very young, is something everyone can relate to on some level. Now, we obviously all don't have a body buried in a marsh or a former hospital or anything, but I think everybody's got things in their past they regret, and that theme of you think you've got away with it but you haven't is just something that I seem to be drawn to time and again.
And when you're writing it, when you're structuring it, because the novel flips between the past and the present, mm-hmm. How do you do that? Do you write one strand and then the other, or do you write it chapter by chapter?
I wish I could write in a structured way. You're asking me as though I've got a method, and you're really flattering me. What I tend to do, actually, is I will always write scenes of interesting things happening. Sometimes it will just be two people meeting for the first time, and it's that relationship that sets off all the events in the book, and other times it will be a big scene, you know, it will be a crime scene or an argument or a love scene, or it would just be something, moments that I think make the book. And then the hard work is stringing those all together in a way that makes readers turn the pages. What you've got to do is you've got to keep asking questions. So Stone Mothers is told backwards, so it starts in the present day, then it flips back a few decades to when this psychiatric hospital was an abandoned building, and then a bit further back in the century when it was a working hospital. Once you've got a structure like that, that makes up my mind. So I think, well, you know, there's so many ways I could do this. I could do it with three time frames constantly cutting between them all. But if I decide to go backwards, then those are my rules. It's almost as though I'm writing a brief for myself, because the more, so this is my seventh book, and the more I write, it's not that I'm stuck for ideas, it's just that I can see every possibility laid out, almost like an old-fashioned choose-your-own-adventure book. And so making a big rule for myself, such as here is your structure, it's three acts moving backwards through time, it stops it sprawling a little bit.
And is there an element for you of wanting to do something different to make it more interesting for yourself?
Yeah, I don't want to be bored, because if I'm bored, so will my readers be. And I think it's very difficult. The kind of books I write, my readers want the same thing but different, and that's what publishers want as well. So they want, I know now what readers love about my books, and they like relationships. They really enjoy friendships between women, especially if they're a bit toxic. They like relationships between men and women as well, or any, you know, couple relationships of any gender, and the dynamics there and what happens to ordinary people. So I'm not talking about hardened criminals, ordinary people caught up in terrible events, and they love the feeling of this could happen to you. And they also like atmosphere. Stone Mothers is full on gothic. I had to scale it back at times before I would stop it turning into complete Hammer horror. So they know what they want, but also you've got to be careful within that, that you don't write to a formula, especially since so many themes, like we've just mentioned, you know, the past intruding on the present, carry over, and structure is one way to stop that happening. You want a kind of brand is such a cynical word to apply, but you know, when I love my favorite novelists because I know that they're going to deliver something. So I love Maggie O'Farrell because I know she's going to give me beautiful sentences, but she's also going to tell me a story. And I love Alan Hollinghurst because I know that he's just going to give me beautiful sentences, and the story is buried and I'm going to have to work harder for it. And there are other writers who, you know, you don't read an Agatha Christie for her prose, but you do read it because it's so easy and it's like just falling straight in, and it's bang, 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 pure story from the first page.
The asylum, the mental hospital in Stone Mothers, very clearly drawn out. Did you have a grand plan of it in your head?
I based it on a template of what was, so lots of your listeners will know the name Colney Hatch. I live near it. It's now luxury flats called Princess Park Manor, but in its day, Colney Hatch Asylum was the biggest mental hospital in London. And it was the place, you know, when you were teasing someone and saying the men in white coats were after you, Colney Hatch would be where they came to take you to. It's quite vulgar, actually. It looks a bit like Buckingham Palace, you know, not particularly inspiring. But I did have a floor plan, and I was very clear that this was the men's wing and this was the women's wing. And I also looked at the development plans, you know, when it was turned into flats. These nice little one-bed studios were in the old padded cells, and the lovely gym used to be a chapel. And, you know, I looked at lots and lots of mental hospitals, which now are luxury flats, which nice Victorian buildings will be in about 20 years. So, yeah, I was very inspired by that place. But what I had to change was I had to take it out of London, where I live, and put it in East Anglia. I knew that I needed, to be blunt, I needed the action to take place where nobody can hear you scream and you're not constantly monitored by CCTV. And I wanted that kind of agoraphobia of the Fens to inform not just the atmosphere, but also the action. So the hospital in my novel has been shut down and devastated the community around it. My mum lives in Leyston in Suffolk, and you can see generations after the foundry closed there, it never got back on its feet in terms of employment, even with the power station at Sizewell down the road. For that to happen, a community has to be isolated. It has to be out there where you're not well served by public transport. You need a job. And when industry goes, whether that's manual industry or it's something like a hospital, which would have employed generations of the same family, you know, what comes up? There's a new Tesco down the road and there's 16 jobs and there's 200 of you unemployed. There's a certain kind of unemployment that's specific to the countryside. And I wanted to look at that in detail, so I couldn't have put it in London. And I put it in Suffolk as well because I am a massive townie and it's really the only part of the English countryside I know very well. But I think I do know it. I'm there a lot.
And of course it's topical, mental health awareness, women's mental health. Mm. Was it topical when you wrote it?
It's kind of never not been topical. I suppose it is in the sense that the stigma around mental health is being broken down, and that's a brilliant thing. And women, not so much women in mental health, but women being believed or not, especially in relation to men who would rather they stopped talking or men who would like to curtail their ambition, that's obviously topical. There was no shortage of resources. You look back and this story's been going on since Georgian times. Women have been put away for not towing the line for a long, long time. The only thing that I wish I could have done, but I didn't have space in the story, and I did think about it, but it would have been a bit like me banging my political soapbox, is I didn't get to address the crisis in funding for mental health. So it's brilliant that you've got ambassadors like Prince Harry and William talking about how important it is to have a conversation. But if you want to have that conversation and you can't afford a private therapist, and you've got 12 weeks waiting for just the preliminary appointment on the NHS, that's, I think, the most pressing topical thing, and that fell through the cracks in my book.
And it's a psychological thriller, so you have to get inside not just the head of your characters, but the head of your reader, presumably. Where do you start?
I think it's more letting the readers into my head, actually. try not to think too much about readers consciously. So if you actually sit there and imagine somebody looking at my book in a shop or turning the pages, I find that quite inhibiting. So if I think about, right, what you've got to do is make the story work, and your duty is to the story and the characters, and if you concentrate on that, then it's going to be good to read. So no, I try not to think too much about my readers, because it's death when you do. I mean, I love them. I'm really grateful for the fact that there's enough of them to keep doing what I do 7, 8, 9 books in. But if I think too much about the book being out there in a physical object, then you're kind of looking at it from the wrong direction. I think you've got to look at it from the inside. And if you get the story right and you do your job right, then by definition, the readers will stay with you.
And what's next for you?
I'm writing another book. I'm always writing another book. This one is a thriller about a ballerina who can't dance anymore, and the breakdown she has and the things that she turns to something desperate to replace ballet. I haven't got a great picture yet because I'm still writing it, I'm still researching it, but every time I read something new, I go off on a tangent. So at the moment, I'm obsessed with the fact that in the Soviet Union, whenever a leader died or there were problems, they would just put Swan Lake on the TV. All the TV stations were shut down and Swan Lake would play and play and play. So anybody over about 35, 40 who grew up in a Soviet country, they just associate the music from Swan Lake. Oh, God, there's been another coup, or the president's dead or something. What I've got to be careful about, as you know, I was talking earlier about the mental health current crisis and how that isn't relevant to my book. What I've got to be careful now, is this actually anything to do with my story, or is this just me going down click holes and rabbit warrens instead of actually writing my book, which I think it probably is at this stage.
And Stone Mothers by Erin Kelly is published by Hodder and Stanton. Listening to that with me on Bookmark today is our studio guest Louise Als, here to talk about her short story collection Notes Towards Recovery. I asked Erin there if she ever thought about her readers. When you're writing your short stories, are you thinking of about your readers?
I'm not. I'm so sorry.
No, it's all right. You don't have to think about your
sorry,
readers.
Sorry, readers.
You're not second-guessing what they might be thinking.
No, I'm not. I don't know that I would even know where to begin doing that.
As a short story reader yourself, though, presumably when you're reading a short story, as you say, because you know it's a limited time, you are trying to guess. Well, I am. Maybe I'm trying to putting my feelings onto other people, how it's going to end.
Yes, and what's important? Which telling detail of the three you've just read is the one you should really remember? Yes, absolutely. I read as a reader and I also read as a writer.
And I didn't ask you why it's called Notes Towards Recovery.
One of the stories is called Notes Towards Recovery. It's a particular favourite of mine, that story. Although, yes, anyhow. Originally, I had been working with the title Lacunae, spaces, gaps, and that's from the Latin lake, so I was still hung up on that watery motif. Luckily, my brilliant supervisor, Dr. Colette Paul, a short story writer herself, pointed out that Lacunae gave the reader no indication of the genre or what to expect, that it's an unusual word, and that Barbara Kingslover had recently written a book with a very similar title. So then looking through the titles of the short stories, I thought notes is an interesting word because it can be a brief dispatch, it can be a note to yourself, it can be a memory aid. Towards, as a preposition, suggests movement. So perhaps positive. I was looking for some sort of hope. And recovery, I think, is a very hopeful word. Although there's something one has had to recover from, the fact that it's paired with towards means that recovery is possible. So it seemed like a slightly more uplifting title than
And you've
others.
Had to recover yourself because you were in, what hurricane was it?
Hurricane Ivan, yes.
And lost almost everything.
Yes. Category 5 when it hit my then home of Grand Cayman.
What kind of effect did that have on you as a person and as a writer?
As a person, I think it has made me much stronger. That sounds so cliche. Much kinder. Much more empathetic with people. And as a writer, I had talked for years about becoming a writer, but it was the hurricane that gave me the push to actually do something about it. So I applied to various courses, and then I went to Bath Spa for my master's and came here to Cambridge for my PhD, started sending things out for consideration. And
we're talking scary stuff here. I mean, you were hiding in a closet, is that right?
Oh, yeah, it was terrifying. Well, I tell people it was more terrifying after the fact, because during the hurricane I was absolutely convinced I was going to die. So there was nothing I could do. I felt that it was out of my hands. But afterwards, when I hadn't died, navigating, using that word again, navigating the changed landscape of the island, and my personal life, my work life.
And the absolute devastation there must have been when you emerged.
Yes.
Well, let's hear some music now. This is, perhaps appropriate track, R.E.M., Everybody Hurts. Why this one?
I think it's true. I think we've all felt loss. I think, and as Erin was just saying, we have regrets, we have secrets, some of which we acknowledge and some of which we perhaps never acknowledge.
When your day is long,
Mark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations rather than books.
And our guest on Bookmark today, our studio guest, is Louise Els, here to talk about her short story collection, Notes Towards Recovery. And you're going to read for us now, Louise.
I would love to. Thank you. I will read from Preservation, a bit from the middle of the story. It's the conflict or the tension, the anxiety of the story. And just to let you know, this is a woman, Valerie, who has just come back from hospital. She's visiting her mother, who's very ill in the hospital. She started making marmalade and then she fell asleep. It was a hissing noise that woke her. Disoriented, it took some time for her to remember where she was, why, and to get to the kitchen where the marmalade was boiling over the top of the pot and spitting as it hit the open flame. No! The brand new stove, covered. Already the heady citrus smell was overwhelmed by the stench of burning sugar. Valerie grabbed at the nearest handle, realizing how hot it was only as she touched it. She pulled back her hand, swearing, but she hadn't let go soon enough. Her palm was burnt, and in her haste she'd pulled the pot askew. There was no time to reach for an oven glove or do anything more than back away and watch as the pot teetered on the edge of the stove, a wave of dark orange syrup swelling, then sloshing over the side. It seemed to hesitate then. In slow motion, it fell. For an instant, there was a waterfall of translucent liquid transformed into a stained glass window by the winter sun, which caught each individual piece of amber peel in its spiraled dance. There had been a moment during their wedding when she'd faltered, closed her eyes, and prayed for a sign that her sister, who had boycotted the City Hall ceremony, was wrong. She'd opened her eyes just as sunlight entered the room, throwing up bright patterns which masked the dull walls, reminding her that all things were possible. But it was only an instant. Then the pot was bouncing once, twice on the floor, spraying treacly liquid over the stove, the fridge, the walls, and the cabinets, spreading across the floor, splattering her shirt and jeans, gumming into her hair, boiling sugar everywhere. There was nothing she could do. She had to wait. The wrinkles rippled as the jam started to solidify. It would have been a lovely set. She dipped a finger into a nearby puddle on the floor, blew softly, then licked it. Her mother especially would have loved it. Just the right balance of sweet to tart.
Thank you, Louise. As you're saying, that's about Valerie, and the women. These are women's stories, or about women, aren't they?
Very much so, yes.
And it's also, is there something for you about, we talked about observing earlier, having spent time in the UK and then gone back to Canada, to then observe Canadian life. Did that give you a new reflection on it, you know, a new aspect on it.
Absolutely. So much was the same and exactly as I'd remembered, and so much was very different. Things have changed quite dramatically.
And all the stories are set in this area.
Yes.
None in the cities.
Very few. There's one in Toronto. Get Dispatches, which, interestingly enough, speaks to an old mental asylum.
And yes, because Erin was saying she's very much a city girl. Are you very much a countryside girl then?
I believe I am, yes.
Well, we'll come back to you in just a moment, Louise. Let's hear from Sarah Watling now. Sarah won the 2016 Tony Lothian Prize for her proposed biography of the Olivier sisters. It was published to acclaim earlier this year and examines the extraordinary lives of Marjorie, Daphne, Noel and Brynhild Olivier. Rupert Brooke was said to be in love with all of them, while D.H. Lauren described them as wrong. Their biography takes in two world wars, colonial Jamaica and Edwardian Cambridge. The Daily Telegraph described it as thoroughly fascinating, and The Guardian said it was compelling. When I met Sarah, I asked her why she'd chosen to call the book Noble Savages.
Well, Noble Savages, it's taken from a quote by the author Bunny Garnett, who grew up with the sisters in the Surrey countryside. And he described them as children, as noble in looks and manners and attitude of mind, but that also they could be as unthinkingly cruel as savages. So that just really struck me as a great description. It's a very arresting description. And I thought it was a strange description for small girls, really. And the more I read about them, the more it seemed to capture for me that this dual approach that people took to them. They found them wild and intriguing and mysterious, but almost because of that, they also found them as if there was maybe something slightly wrong about them, or maybe a little bit dangerous even. So I was quite interested in the tension between those two ideas and the way that people tended to react to them, I think.
And when did you first come across the Olivier sisters?
It's terrible. I mean, I can't remember the first time I even came across their names. I was doing some research on Newnham College, where I'd studied as an undergraduate. I was looking at gender relations before and after the First World War in Cambridge. And so, of course, I was kind of reading about Rupert Brooke and the neo-pagans. And I think I just kept coming across this description of the Olivier sisters, as if they were kind of a single entity. And they were described as beautiful or striking or mysterious. And those are things that drew me. And then, you know, as I got to read more about them, they seemed more and more interesting. Two of them had studied at Newnham, so I was interested in that angle. The more I read, the more fascinated I became.
And as you say, they were described always collectively as a group. For you as a writer, was it easy to differentiate between them?
I think so. I mean, I think the more I got to know them, and the lovely thing about reading people's letters and diary entries is that you feel like you do get to know them quite well. I felt I was able to distinguish between them, and it was important to me when I was writing that you could see them all as individuals. But I also think the fact that they were this tight-knit group of sisters was the crucial part in their individual personalities as well. And I think it helped form them, it helped give them the kind of support network and strength of their own convictions to kind of not be worried about what other people were saying about them to some extent. And so I think sisterhood was, you know, an important way to look at them as well, and I try and do that in the book.
Yes, they led very modern lives, didn't they?
They did. I mean, they were very ahead of their time. And one of the questions I tried to think about in the book is whether that was really an advantage for them, because over the course of the 20th century, things went in waves for women. You know, it wasn't a straightforward process of progress. So I think sometimes, you know, their expectations of life were not always met, and that, I think, must have been a very difficult thing for them at times.
There are extraordinary achievements that you list in the book. Why do we not know about them?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's partly that they were very private. They didn't particularly feel the need to broadcast their story. Noel, in particular, was very reticent as a sort of personality, but also, you know, when she was being approached by biographers of Rupert Brooke, for example, she preferred to keep her secrets. She wanted to protect the memories and reputations of her sisters and her friends who passed away. So I think it's partly that, and I think it's partly the fact that Rupert Brooke became this huge figure that kind of eclipsed their story a little bit, or when they were known about, they were being looked at from his perspective, you know, so it was impossible to see them in the round.
And I suppose when we hear the name Olivier, we think Laurence Olivier as well.
Yeah, I think there is that element. Yes, I mean, he was a cousin of theirs. He was a fair bit younger than them, I think, and they were closer with his sister than they were with him. But one of Daphne's grandchildren told me a story about going into Laurence Olivier's dressing room once, but I got the impression it was the only time he ever met him. So, yeah, they were kind of in that shadow as well, I suppose.
And they lived through two world wars. What effect did that have on them?
I mean, obviously, living through the World Wars was devastating for everyone, I imagine. But particularly the First World War, it came as a sort of huge blow to all their hopes and all their optimism for life, I think. But equally, it was one of those strange situations where, although it was this dreadful time and none of them would have wanted to live through it, there were opportunities thrown up by the First World War for women. And Noel probably had, you know, much more rigorous training as a young doctor than she would have done without it. So there was that odd tension for her. She was devastated by the war. She hated it. She lost most of the important young men in her life. And yet, you know, it was this time of fulfillment in terms of her career.
Tell me about the structure of the book and why you decided to structure it that way.
It's structured in 7 fragments. I mean, they're quite long fragments, obviously, because it's the whole book. But I do jump between those fragments and I leave out sort of whole years in their lives. And that was partly because in ordinary people's lives, and that, you know, in some ways they were quite ordinary, lots is going on that isn't actually that unusual or interesting to an outsider. You know, like having babies is a huge event in a woman's life probably, but equally pans out the same way for everyone in some ways. And also because I wanted to reflect the fact that these women, they weren't public figures, they weren't politicians or famous writers or anything like that, so there wasn't a complete paper trail for their lives, and I didn't want to sort of give the impression that I knew everything about them when I knew that I didn't. So I wanted to kind of reflect that in the structure of the book and leave those gaps. I think I say in the instruction, I leave the gaps where I found them.
I suppose even with the gaps, it's a thick book, but I suppose you're covering 4 lives. How long did it take you to research?
I think I probably spent about 3 years on the book in total, but I've been thinking about them before that, obviously.
And so what's it like now to see it as a published book?
It's really strange. I so admire them, and it's really nice to share them with people and have other people realise how fascinating they were and fantastic they were. But having followed them around for all this time on my own, it is very strange to see other people with my book.
Do you have a favourite sister?
Of course I don't. No, I would feel terrible about having a favourite sister. I mean, at different times, I prefer one at one moment. I do feel slightly protective towards Marjorie just because she didn't have children, of course, and so I felt like there was nobody else who was really invested in her story quite as much as I was, and I really wanted, because of the way Marjorie's life sort of panned out, I really wanted to restore her history to her and her individuality as a woman with so much potential that was wasted.
And they were all very beautiful. Was that a help or a hindrance?
I think it was quite an annoyance to them sometimes, particularly for Brynhild, who spent so much time fending off the attentions of young men. It's interesting, I think, because I think there's still really these days a problem with women being expected to respond in a certain way to male attentions. If a young man fell for Brynhild, they expected her to deal with that, you know, it became her problem. And really, she was just trying to get on with her life and fulfil her ambitions and decide what she wanted from life. So it was a bit of a hindrance sometimes, I think.
Do you think you would have liked them? Would you have got along with them?
I think I would have done. I mean, I feel like I probably would have just gazed at them from afar, you know. I don't think they would have had any need for me.
And if they were still around, and if you could ask one of them one question, what would you ask and who would you ask it to?
That's a very difficult one. As I say, there are so many gaps in the paper trail. There are questions that linger, but I don't know. They were so private, I feel like maybe I would have let them keep their secrets.
Did they have descendants?
They do, they have lots. I think between them there were 16 children, and lots of them had grandchildren, so there's a huge family, and I was very fortunate in getting to know quite a lot of them, and they were very generous with their sort of time and opening their archives. I remember the first person I got in touch with was one of Daphne's sons. He invited me to come visit him, and I went there with no expectations, really, and I got there, and their dining room table was just covered with letters and photographs, and it was a really nice beginning, and it kind of went from there.
It must have been really nice, given your interest, to actually touch things that they touched and see the handwriting.
It was fantastic. There's some special magic in seeing someone's handwriting, and there's a lovely doodle that Noel drew in a letter to her mother of herself when she was in her mid-teens, which is actually on the end papers of the book now, and it's just such a lovely insight into how she was seeing herself at that moment. And she was always looking at herself in comparison to her sisters, who were so beautiful and well-dressed, and she's this sort of dumpy little figure with huge feet, and moments like that were really lovely.
And what's next for you?
I don't know. I mean, I'm still like slightly immersed in the life of the Olivia sisters, so I need to extricate myself and find something new to do.
And Noble Savages by Sarah Watlin is published by Jonathan Cape. We've been chatting to Louise Ells on Bookmark today about her short story collection, Notes Towards Recovery. Sarah's saying, perhaps not unsurprising there because it was a research work, that it took her 3 years to finish that. And I know we've talked about how all these short stories kind of took you a lifetime to write. But in reality, how long does one of your short stories take to write? in terms of putting words on a page?
I would say first draft takes anywhere from a month to 5 months, and then the revision, well, I could still be revising them if they weren't in a book.
Now, how many revisions do they have?
Well, interestingly, my PhD looked at Alice Munro's narrative techniques. So what I did, it was a practice-based PhD. I wrote the collection, and then I looked at Munro's revision techniques, as I believed they were, and then I applied those, or tried to apply those, to my short stories. So I would say minimum 7 and maximum perhaps 27, 30 revisions.
Wow. That's 30 revisions, that's a lot. And where do they start, the ideas for these stories?
Oh, goodness, anywhere, everywhere. That's not very helpful, sorry. A snatch of conversation, something that evokes a memory through touch or smell or taste, just a random idea.
And do you generally, I mean, we touched on this earlier, generally feel people are more open to short stories now, perhaps because we have less time? And so a short story on a bus journey or a train journey, that's more acceptable now, and we can download them, etc.?
I would like to think so. It was interesting that Cat Person was the most read short story in The New Yorker of 2017, I believe, and it came out in December, so it only had a month to say. I mean, it went viral. It was incredible that a short story did that. Although, interestingly, a number of the readers didn't realize it was fiction. They thought it was an essay. So the New Yorker's always had a short story every week. But yes, perhaps people are reading on the internet. Perhaps they're reading on their phones. Perhaps a short story seems like a commutable distance.
And I'm going to ask you that question now that you mentioned earlier on that people ask less, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So would you ever write a novel?
Absolutely, I would.
It's very different skills, isn't it? It's very a very different approach to matters.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Have you plans?
Well, write what you know. I have a draft of a novel I'm currently revising about a Canadian expat who survives a Category 5 hurricane in the Caribbean.
Is that autobiographical?
And I'm also writing a novel about a middle-aged woman who remarries and her second husband is living with early onset dementia. Something else about which I have some knowledge.
And what's next for you then? I mean, are those the next on your list, or do you have another collection, another short story collection?
I am also working on a short story collection now that I've left the Fens and the Brecks in East Anglia, and I'm back in northeastern Ontario. I'm writing about this area, which I walked and loved so much while I was living here.
And given that you've got all these different projects on the go, is there a typical working day for you, a typical structure of a day?
Absolutely not, no.
That sounds quite nice. And you've been here teaching, and you teach back in Canada.
Yes.
What effect does that have on your own writing?
Oh, fantastic. I had the most brilliant group of students in Canada. We were reading contemporary short stories, so 3 anthologies of up-to-the-minute short stories. The students are much younger than I am, so it was interesting, their perspectives, their thoughts, their interpretations, their readings of the stories. But we had some really, really helpful discussions, helpful for them, I hope, but certainly helpful for me, about short stories, about endings, about what makes up a short story.
And their creative writing as well. Is that something that feeds back into your own? Without stealing it, of course.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Always interesting to talk about writing and someone else's writing and someone else's writing process.
So Notes Towards Recovery is published by Latitude 46.
Yes.
A Canadian publisher, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, based in Sudbury, which is the next big town along from
And what
I
was
live.
The journey to publication?
Oh, it was lovely. It was so easy. I'm so lucky. I met Heather Campbell, who owns Latitude 46, at a reading, and we chatted, and she said, oh, when you want to submit, submit. And then I hummed and hawed for a year, and then I submitted, and she said she'd love to publish my stories. So,
oh, that's the dream, isn't
yes,
it? That's
yes.
The dream journey. And what are you reading at the moment? This is a question we ask all our guests on Bookmark. What's on your bedside table?
Oh, a random collection of novels. I am rereading Stoner by John Williams, which I read when I was here. A friend of mine, Carrie Clare, wrote a novel called Mitzi Bites, which is great fun. It's just a romp. It's a mummy blogger who has secrets which come out. I recently read Moon of the Crusted Snow by Wob Rice. He's a local Canadian Indigenous writer. It's a post-apocalyptic, terrifying, terrifying novel. And I've gone down a rabbit hole with Roxane Gay. She's my new authorly crush, so I'm reading all her works.
That's quite a variation there. There's you like that. There's not one genre that you specifically stick to, obviously.
No, I read right across the map.
Great. Well, we'll come back to you for your last choice of music, Louise, but lovely talking to you today. Next show, heads up, our studio guest is Sally Harris. She's talking about her novel. It's a ghost story called Haverscroft. We'll also hear from Joe Nutt about his book, The Point of Poetry. And we'll also hear how the International Booker Prize inspired the Reading Agency to team up with a Cambridge book group. A heads up that all the old episodes of Bookmark are on the Cambridge 105 website, which is cambridge105.co.uk. Since the beginning of time, they're all there, should you feel the need to go back over any. But we'll sign out now, Louise, with your last choice of music, which is Gabriel's Oboe by Ennio Morricone. This is from the film The Mission. Why this one?
I feel this is a particularly haunting piece of music. I tend to be a writer who writes in silence, but if I do have music in the background, it's instrumental rather than songs with words. And this is one I listen to on a regular basis.